Are you ready for an open discussion with the best of the best and the best of what's next? Welcome to the Tony D'Urso Show. Join in on a great conversation today with some of the world's great influencers as they showcase great advice and techniques that made them the game changers they are today. Now, here's Tony D'Urso.
Welcome and thanks for joining in with us. Now, when you hear of technology and that it's our future, you can probably think of a lot of things. What is it that really strikes you? Is this a future age that you want? Yes, you do. You want everything to be super tech? And what would you do? For example, could you write a book a day by having AI finish it? Could you create all the items you need to live as you need them? You know, I mentioned this maybe once or twice. I started writing my writing career with a science fiction book that I never published. And I found that the mind could just keep going on and on when it comes to inventing technology and robots to do everything for you. So I ask you, is there a limit? Is there a point where you only need so much and you only want to do so much? Here's an example. What if you could grow your own food 1,000 pounds a day? Now you can't eat that much, so you wouldn't do it. Well, you'd say, hey, I'm an entrepreneur. I'll sell it to others. Well, what if they can create 1,000 pounds of food a day and all their shoes and clothes that they would ever need? Do you follow my example? So stay tuned here. Pay attention. We're going to talk about shaping the future with Byron Reese. And while we're at it, this is all about helping you and your friends turn your vision into reality. We want to help you get very successful at growing your business to a very high sustainable level and have you have all the food that you can eat too. So let's talk about Byron Reese. He's a 25-year successful tech entrepreneur with multiple IPOs and exits along the way. And his book titles alone really deeply stir the imagination. And I do mean deeply. I'm not even sure where to go with some of them. They're profound. So let me sum it off here. Perhaps the best statement to introduce Byron is one of his quotes where he says, "The biggest problems of tomorrow will not be a lack of jobs, but a shortage of humans to take advantage of all the opportunities technology will offer." That says it all. Let's get into it. Hi, Byron. Welcome to the Tony D'Urso Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The pleasure is mine. The honor is mine. We're all looking forward to getting our brains around shaping the future. So let me ask the big question. We'll go into the past and ask Byron, how did it all happen for you?
How did which part happen?
Well, here you are. You're a multi-author. You're a 25-year serial entrepreneur, multiple IPOs and exits. You've got this game down. How did all of that start for you?
Oh, I don't know. I grew up on a farm in East Texas, and went to university and met my wife there. I mean, she wasn't my wife when I met her. She later became my wife, and. And then I moved to the West Coast. I'm from Texas, and I moved to the West Coast because it seemed like that was where, it seemed like technology was kind of the thing of the moment, and I wanted to be involved in it. And so I did that. And then along the way, I had a couple of successes. And when that happens, people ask you to give talks. And so I started giving talks. And the thing about it is good speakers give the same talk over and over, and I'm a bad speaker. I've never given the same speech twice. And so because I've never had the same audience twice in the same exact moment. So I would always write something new. And over time, all that writing became, I noticed themes I was trying to develop in it. And so I published a book, and then another one, then another one, then another one. And now I'm under contract to write one a year. And so I have one that came out last year. One's coming out next month. And I'm a little over halfway done with the one that's coming out next August.
That's a lot of book writings. Now, somewhere you went from successful entrepreneur in some of the work in the technology, but then you went into a deep dive into technology for the future, into AI, robots, and everything else that we're going to talk about. So where did that vision come into play in all of this?
I write about people and how we got to where we are. I'm actually not all that interested in technology. I'm in and of itself. What technology is like a force multiplier to humans. Because of technology, you're able to amplify what you're able to do. And that is interesting to me because, you know, I think that is, you know, your body runs on 100 watts of power. And if that's all you had, you would feel the limits of that pretty quickly. But what we learned a long time ago was, hey, you know, connect an ox to a cart, and then that's another 200 watts of power. And then, wow, we can dig up fossil fuels, which are basically just sunlight that fell on the earth a long time ago. And we figured out how to harvest that sunlight. And now, if you live in the West, you've got your 100 watts you burn all the time, but there's 10,000 more watts kind of at your disposal. And that's that multiplier that really makes you more than you would be able to do. And so if you think that way, if one thinks that way about technology, artificial intelligence is seemingly the most interesting piece of technology, right? Because we are where we are on this planet because of our brains and our minds and what we know. And if the question is, can a computer think? And that's a question I get very interested in. I started a podcast about it. I started writing books on the topic. I even wrote a philosophy book about AI. I'm not supposed to call it that because, you know, that sounds kind of like chloroform in print. So that's how I got into artificial intelligence. I'm actually, you know, I had this podcast called Voices in AI that I recorded maybe 120 episodes, and I had the most amazing guest on it because this is the great thing about AI is a lot of the early practitioners are still around and they love to talk about it. And I would always ask my guest, I would say, you know, do you think general intelligence is possible? That AI that, you know, is C-3PO and Commander Data and then Scarlett Johansson in Her and Ex Machina, Westworld, like, do you think that's possible? And 96% of my guests said yes. A very interesting thing because I think everybody can agree, we don't know how to build it. And yet they think it's possible. And I don't think it's possible. The rationale on why it's possible, if I would say, well, why do you believe it? We don't know how to do it. Why do you think it's possible? People would say, well, we're machines that think. So, of course, we can build machines that think. And that's the underlying assumption, which is people are machines. And if you think that, then they're right. Like, eventually we'll make a mechanical person, and then 18 months later, that will be twice as good, twice as good, twice as good. But if people are not machines, and you don't have to get all mystical to believe that, like, it isn't a crazy idea. Maybe there's something about human intelligence that cannot be manufactured in a fab. Like, that's not a crazy idea. Then if people are not machines, then you'll never make general intelligence. It's just not what machines are able to do. And I think that. I don't believe we'll ever have general intelligence, which is probably a good thing, by the way. But what it means is we do have this technology. It's going to be a great help to us.
It's very interesting. I think it's been proven people aren't machines. There's some life force that actually operates it, and that life force is intelligent. But the body can be like, I guess to me, is like, you could say in a way the concept machine, but it grows, it permutates, it changes, it goes to an optimum state, and then from there perhaps diminishes depending on things. Very interesting, very insightful. And so now I'm going to ask you, what is the purpose? Is the purpose that you did, you know, just kind of second guess you just a little bit because you wanted to understand this better? You wanted to help people? Why do you do what you're doing in the AI arena?
Well, it is this amazing question before. You know, if I were to ask you, like, can we make it to Mars? You're like, yeah, probably. And, you know, people could gather around and say, well, it's going to take 10 years, it's going to take 20 years, it's going to take 30 years. We can build this kind of ship. And, you know, it would be a discussion. When you talk about what can artificial intelligence do, there isn't that kind of, like, base level start. I mean, it's an open question. Just, exactly what this technology can do. And so I just really wanted to know the answer to the question. It is the question on which everything hangs. Like, you know, that's the big one. Are we not machines, and therefore, I would put it this way. There's a famous quote by Carl Sagan, and maybe you know about the pale blue dot. It was when Voyager was leaving the solar system, Carl Sagan said to NASA, you ought to turn that thing around, take a picture of the Earth. And he did, and it's just this tiny little speck. And no scientific value to that at all. But there's a lot of emotional value. And because he writes and he says, you know, this is it. This is all there is. There is no hope. There's no reason to believe anything is going to come and save us from ourselves. It's up to us. And you know what? Good. Frankly, good. I mean, what a terrible commentary it would be on us is, yeah, we messed things up so badly. Luckily, some aliens came along and fixed it all for us. So it is up to us. Unless we build machines that somehow save us. And I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think it's possible. But that was the question I really wanted to get at the root of.
I like that. And I'm going to address that comment in just one moment. We are talking about shaping the future with Byron Rees, and you can find him at byronrees.com. Let's spell that BYRONREESE.com. There's a lot of good stuff there about his books, about him as an entrepreneur and speaker, and so on and so forth. You can get lost in the world of AI. Get lost? Well, you can get found in the world of AI. So check that out. And you talked about you didn't think it was possible, and you said something else that you didn't think. And it's like, why? Why do you think it's not possible?
Well, the way we do artificial intelligence today is pretty simple. We take a bunch of data about the past, and we look in it for patterns. And when we find those patterns, we use those to predict the future. And that tells you two things about it. It tells you, one, it only works where the future is like the past. You can identify cats because a cat tomorrow looks like a cat did yesterday. It's pretty much the same. And so first, it tells you it can only do things that, and second, it tells you that you kind of have to teach it one thing at a time. I want a spam filter, and so you have to teach it. Here's a billion spam, and here's how you spot them. And then, aha, I can do it. And then you say, I want to go through traffic, and then, aha, I can do that. And so one at a time, we kind of knock these things out. There had been hope. There had been hope of a universal learner, that little bot you could write and just put it out on the internet and say, go figure everything out. And then it comes back, and you just start asking it questions like, how can we have free, unlimited clean energy? And it would say, oh, piece of cake, here's what you do. That was the hope, but it's a very different thing. Like, the technology we have, look at patterns about the past, make predictions about the future. Unfortunately, we use language around it that implies a lot more to it than there is. Like, you know, we name it. Like, you may have a device on your desk that has a name that you can ask it questions and it will answer it. We somehow kind of believe that it's going to be more than that, but that's really all it can do. And to be able to do what a human does, to be creative, to, you see, okay, here's how it kind of works, I think. We have these brains that we don't really understand. Like, if I were to ask you a question like, do you remember the name of your first grade teacher?
No, but I remember she was a lady.
Okay. Do you remember the color teacher of your first bicycle?
Repeat the question. My
The color of your first bicycle.
It was gold. It was a gold Schwinn Stingray with high handlebars.
Now, there's no bicycle location in your brain. It's a mystery how you just did that. I don't know the last time you thought about that bicycle, and yet you were able to retrieve that in a tiny fraction of a second. And nobody knows how you do that. I mean, I could go on and on about that, but nobody knows how to do that. Oh, okay, maybe we figure that out. But that isn't enough. You know what? You have a mind as well as a brain. Now, what is a mind? A mind is everything you can do that it does not seem like an organ should be able to do. You can fall in love. You can be happy, but your stomach doesn't fall in love, presumably. You're creative, and you have a sense of humor. But, you know, none of your cells have a sense of humor. None of your other organs have a sense of humor.
Well, I beg to differ with you. Don't we have a funny bone?
And so we have this mind, and we don't even know what that is. And that's the thing that makes us what we are. But it's harder than that, because we're also conscious. Now, people like to say we don't know what consciousness is, and that it's not quite right. We know exactly what it is. It's the experience of being you. Like a thermometer can measure the temperature of hot water, but it cannot feel warmth. You can feel warmth. You experience the world. And the reason it's such a vexing question, the question of how it is that we're conscious, is not because it's a mystery. Like, science is full of mysteries. That's part of the course. But because it's a mystery that does not seem like it should be possible. There's nothing we understand about physics that can explain how matter, how a rock can have an experience of something. And yet, you're made out of the same thing the rock is. It's just made out of elements. So why are you able to experience? So you have a brain we don't understand that gives rise to a mind we don't understand, maybe. And you have consciousness. And that's the magic of being a human, not our data processing abilities. And so that's why I don't think we're ever going to build things that can mentally replace it. I mean, the people I know who work in AI, their big problem is like getting it to tell the difference when you say A, H, and 8. Like, that's a hard problem. A, H, H, A. Like, that's a hard thing. So to think it's going to replace us. And then, you know, then what people really do is that they get people try to, I think, scare them and tell them, oh, it's coming for your job, and it's going to, you know, you're not going to be able to support yourself. If you have a family, you're not going to be able to support your family. And that thing that you do that makes you special, not that special, it's going to be able to do it. And people tell people that kind of stuff, and it frightens them, and as it should. I mean, it's a horrific thought. And the thing is it's just not true. And that's the thing. It's just not true. You know, I said it. I'll pause there.
You have stimulated quite a lot with that conversation so far. I'm really getting to like this interview. And I would like to say, I usually don't chime in, you're the expert, but I completely feel 100,000,000,000% that there's no way AI will ever replace us, because it can't think, as you say. It doesn't understand. It's actually rather stupid. I think, this is my personal opinion, the more technology we have, the worse we'll get. I have not been able to get my emails to synchronize between my laptop, between my computer and my cell phone for 9 months. My smart machine washer will 3 times fill up with water and empty, losing water, and never wash the clothes, but without, by pushing the same buttons on the 4th time, washes the clothes. You know, my smart, we have vehicles today that use more energy than ever. They shut down at a stop sign or a stoplight. They create more wear and tear. I think we've gone, this is my point of view, maybe next year's book by Byron Reese, we've gone over the edge on technology. This is my point of view. You're the expert. You've written the books on it. Just everywhere I go, I see more hassle on technology. I think we've passed where it's useful. And that I think is a lead into something I saw that you're good. Not that you're good. That's a bad introduction. Something that I saw that you like to speak about called reasoned optimism. And I'm wondering if that's at play. If we discuss that, because I'm like, how does that fit in to this whole thing on AI?
I mean, I agree with you about like the what technology can and can't do, and I also think I have a sense on why it does seem frightening. It isn't just that there, it isn't that there's a conspiracy of people trying to scare you. And I would put it this way, which is if you went back in time 25 years, just to 1997, the consumer web was very young, right? Like people were on it, people knew what it was. And if you went back in time and you showed somebody a browser and said, "Wow, in 25 years, you're going to have billions of people using this. What do you think that's going to do to jobs?" They may have said, "Well, that's going to be really hard on the yellow pages, and phone books are going out of business, and the newspapers, they're probably going to go out of business because we'll get our news online, and people will probably shop online. There are not going to be any more travel agents. Like, you don't need them. You'll do it yourself. You're not going to have stockbrokers." And you know what? They would have been right about everything. I mean, everything. But what they would never have said is, "Oh, you're going to have Uber, Airbnb, Etsy, eBay, Amazon, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, a million new companies. You're going to have a million companies." And that's the problem, is that we always can see what it's going to destroy. That's pretty easy. But none of us can see what it's going to make. I mean, there was like 10 years between the consumer internet and then somebody said, "Wow, I should rent my sofa out to somebody." Like, none of it was obvious. In fact, you know, we're so far ahead. We've built so much more technology than we've been able to implement that really good businesses are going to be built around just figuring out new ways to apply the technology we already know how to do. And that's the kind of problem that's accessible to everybody. Now, your question was about optimism, and that feeds into it, which is there was a time in our past where we were down to probably like 1,000 mating pairs of humans. You can look at the diversity in our DNA, and you can kind of get a sense of how what a kind of bottleneck it came to before it spread out. Like cheetahs had it even worse. Like they got down to maybe 40 cheetahs in the last ice age, and so every cheetah alive is clone basically of every other cheetah. But we got down to 1,000 mating pairs, and if you think about it, we were an endangered species, right? Like, who would have bet on us at that point? And we were a timid species because it served us well, right? Like, if there was a big rock and you thought it was a bear and you ran away, not so bad. But if it was a bear and you were like, "Ah, it's just a big rock, that's not going to bother me," you know. So if you were timid and frightened and cautious, you would have made it through that, and we inherited all of that. So our inclination is to be very suspicious of new things and just cautious about them. And yet, since that time, say 70,000 years ago, we've sort of been up the whole time with occasional setbacks. We live longer, and our children survive more. And you know, you can take any place in the world you want, and things are probably better there today than they were 100 years ago, and then 500, and then 1,000. So, on the one hand, you have things getting kind of better all the time. You have more individual liberty. You have more people who are educated. Women are no longer regarded as chattel, as property, legally, at least in many places. Slavery is at least outlawed, even though it hasn't been eliminated. Like, we're making this progress, and I don't understand. I really don't, how people look at that and say, "Yeah, it's 80,000 years and nothing but winning, but it's all over. That's it. It's turning down now." And I think you compound that with all these fears about, like, how are you going to support yourself, and how are you going to get enough money to eat, and all these things, and it creates this anxiety about the future. So I'm an optimist because I look at the span of human history. I only really have to know three things to be an optimist. One, that technology continues to grow, and technology is that thing that multiplies what we're able to do. And so I don't think it's a hard bet to say we're going to have more. And then the second thing, and maybe people push back on this, is that most people are basically good. We would have eaten each other a long time ago if it weren't the case. I'll give you a real thing that just happened to me. I sold something on eBay, and I packaged it up very nicely. I triple boxed it, literally. I shipped it, and the person got it. And they opened it, and then they filed a report again on eBay saying that I just sent them a brick. I mean, I did not send them a brick. They said, oh, yeah, I got the box. Yeah, I got the box, but when I opened it up, it was just full of junk. It was just full of a broken rocks. Give me my money back. And, of course, eBay did. Now, you realize that if 3% of people did that, the whole thing would break. Credit cards wouldn't work. There's a reason that credit card fees are like 2.5%, but they can give you a 2% rebate because most people are honest. Most people pay their bill and then don't deny it, right? The guy who filed the report on me, he's very much the exception. So one, we're going to know more. Two, people basically on net are good. And three, we have a long history of being able to apply these technologies to solve the problem. Now, I'll be the first to say, we have a long way to go. But does that mean that, the trajectory has changed? I don't have any reason to believe that. I have, for instance, last thing I'll say here, I have spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out the half-life of a job, and I think it's 50 years. I think every 50 years we lose about half of our jobs. And I think it's been going on for about 250 years, and I don't have a sense it's any faster or slower. I've been trying to think of one job that's been eliminated in the last 5 years. Can you think of one? A job that technology has eliminated in the last 5 years. We used to have a typing pool 5 years ago, and obviously that's not one. And it's really hard. I can't come up with one. And so this idea, and then you say, well, that sure doesn't feel like the kind of reporting I get, because the kind of reporting I get says, it's over. The machines are going to do it. And they're going to have this. And then they make all these movies about it that look so convincing. And again, I don't think it's a conspiracy. Look, I like to see Will Smith fight the robot and iRobot as much as anybody, right? But it's not real. And what happens is people, myself included here, start doing something called reasoning from fictional evidence. You see that, and you say, oh, yeah, that's what's going to happen.
So we think it can happen, but you think it doesn't, it can't happen. And I agree with you because AI so far, I'm not convinced with AI. I am not convinced at all. It's not where it needs to be. That doesn't mean to say that it won't create a whole bunch more jobs and a lot more economy happens and a lot more sales happen. I see sales and websites and concepts and items that you wouldn't think twice about 5 years ago. And today it's a $1 billion industry or whatever. It's like, what? Really? You made all this money about this? It's just amazing, all of the opportunities. So I think whether it's true or not, and I do agree with you, AI cannot ever, I don't think, could ever really be AI without putting a spirit in that machine. But that's beside the point. That's a different conversation. But I do believe it creates a lot more jobs and it creates a lot more opportunity for us, don't you think? As you were saying, it just multiplies.
Here's how I tend to think about that. What is that dynamic? So you're losing half the jobs every 50 years, right? And yet somehow we keep full employment. With dips, every now and then there's a Great Depression or a pandemic, but we've had full employment. And then you say, well, how in the world do you lose half the jobs every 50 years and have full employment? And the way I think of it is, imagine there's a spectrum of jobs. And at one end, there's all these high-tech, high-pay, high-skill, brand-new, awesome jobs, a geneticist. And then on the other end of it, there are low-wage, low-skill, low-training jobs, the order taker at a fast food place. And what happens is technology comes in And it creates all these new jobs up there at the top, like geneticists on that end of the spectrum. But the jobs it destroys are on the other end, like the order taker at fast food. And then here's the thing. What people say, usually smugly, they say, look, do you really think those people that lost their job to automation have the skills to do the jobs of tomorrow? And the answer is no. That's not how it ever works. What happens is, like, some biology professor is going to be a geneticist. Then some high school biology teacher gets the college job. And then the substitute biology teacher gets hired on full time, backfills the high school biology teacher all the way down the line. So the question is, can everybody do a job just a little harder than the job they have today? And I think so. And that's 250 years of economic history. Technology comes in, destroys stuff at the bottom, makes stuff at the top, and shifts everybody up. Destroy, make, shift. And therefore, you can have full employment and rising wages while you're destroying jobs nonstop. That is almost unbreakable, because there's an infinite number of jobs in the world. Like, you can pluck them out of the air. All you have to do is say, okay, I can take something, a lot of clay, and I can apply labor and technology to it, and I can make something else, a vase. And the difference between what that clay cost me and what I can sell that vase for, that's a wage. That's it. And the thing about it is, technology increases your productivity. So it increases that wage. It multiplies what you're able to do. So it can't eat the jobs. Like, there's a finite number of jobs. And if you give one to a robot, then you got an unemployed person. It's like, I get it. I get that that's what it feels like. And it's not like I get it. I mean, I really do, but I just don't think that's the dynamic.
Well, Byron, that's very interesting. And again, this is very stimulating, and I'm sure there's lots of opinions and points of view. And what I'm thinking about is what you talked about, how whatever the numbers, half the jobs disappear, yet even more come. And here we are, we're entrepreneurs, we're businessmen sitting here, and we have to look at the future and what's going on, and we have to do something that we hear more and more of. We have to innovate. Things are changing. There's more and more technology going out, whether we like it or not. You know, it's huge. So how do you have any tips or suggestions on how to do that?
When you say we, do you mean individuals who at companies, or do you mean companies as a whole have to innovate?
Well, the audience, we're entrepreneurs, businessmen. We may have 5-10 people, we may have 100 people, mm-hmm. but we're in charge. We built a company from scratch, and because we're entrepreneurs, we are still in business, for those that are in business, despite all the changes, because we know how to move and shake to changes.
I would say two things that may be useful. You know, just a minute ago when I was describing that litany of jobs, high skill, high pay, and low skill, low pay, I would encourage people to look at their own day like that. Because if you look at how you spend your day, you're doing a range of things all along that. You're doing some high skill, high value work, and then you're also, I don't know, trying to figure out how to make your washing machine work or something like that. And then if you apply that same thing, you say, how can I use technology to create more opportunities up here? And how can I use technology to destroy things I'm having to do down here? Then you have that same dynamic as the macro economy. So that's what I would say, like, at a personal level, like, look at what you can use technology to destroy, and that frees your time up to do those higher value things. So then what you're doing is basically applying that macro thing to your own life. But at more of a company level, there's a sense that I think a lot of people have, like, I personally fail a lot more than I succeed. I wish I had a clever ending to that. I really do. I mean, I think the only virtue I have is I just keep going. But I fail 5 times out of 6 or something like that, really. And so I feel like I have a pretty good ringside seat on what that looks like. And people, I think, like to believe that business is a matter of having a few rules that you remember, you keep in your head, and you apply those. And if you do that, you're going to stay pretty much on track. And, you know, I mean, I remember In Search of Excellence, or, you know, whatever they would say, you know, like, stick to the knitting, right? Like, oh, they didn't stick to the knitting. But the problem with it is every piece of business advice I know of, there's an opposite piece of business advice that says the same thing. For instance, oh, why did they fail? Well, they stuck to the knitting. They didn't change with the times. Oh, they should have changed with the times. Or a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, but nothing ventured, nothing gained. Or look before you leap, but he who hesitates is lost. Like, every one of these lives in a pair. And so it's an illusion to think, okay, there's just a few rules. If you just remember these, you're going to be okay. Because the challenge is knowing when should you look before you leap, and when is he who hesitates lost. Like, that's the thing. Now, I got really interested in countries and companies that did actually make, when technology came along and just like, just really upended them. They got through it. And I spent a fair amount of time studying those. And I really like thinking about Western Union. Like, they are the telegraph company, the telegrams. And it was even worse, because in the war, in World War II, that was, you got a telegram when your loved one died. And so they had this piece of, if they were a telegram company, we don't send telegrams anymore. But they said, no. We're all about secure information. And so then they said, well, that's a superpower. Like, that is independent of technology. So now, what information do we need to send securely? I know, let's send money around. And so I would say that. I would say if I had a business now, I would think really long and hard about what is I hate using the word superpower, but what is it? What is that thing that you do that you feel like, hey, as long as we're doing that, we're okay? I've been fortunate to visit the Lego factory in Denmark on more than one occasion, and I met with the president. And, you know, Lego went through a hard time, and I said, how did you get through that hard time? It's like in the 90s that they had the hard time. And he said, well, you know, there are a lot of things, but we figured out that what we know how to do is make this brick. Like, that's the thing we know how to do. Maybe we can't run theme parks, and maybe we can't do all these other things. We know how to make that brick better than anybody. And so that's what they decided their superpower was, and that's what they put all their energy behind. So those would be my two things. Figure out how you can use technology to destroy things you're having to do, free you up to do higher value things, and then look deep inside and figure out what your superpower is.
That's very insightful, and I've got to think about that. There's a lot I can say about that. But one other thing that I kind of think, while we're innovating, we're moving, is the education of all this. It's just changed so much, and it's changing even more. What do you see, or where do you see we're going in terms of education on all of this?
You mean as a society, how are we educating people, and how is that changing?
Yeah, because that determines what we know, what we do, how we work, how we develop more technology. Mm-hmm. It's all part of that, and that's all shifting as well.
Well, look, we have a university system that is a 12th century French invention, and its singular characteristic is that it is highly durable. It has not changed in 1,000 years. They had, and to think about everything that's happened in the last 1,000 years, you know, you had bubonic plague and movable type and the Protestant Reformation, all of that, but somehow universities made it all the way through. So there's something about them that's resilient. Now, our K-12 system, that's a German invention in the 19th century. And that was designed to do something that it does very well, by the way. It was designed to make factory workers. So it was modeled after a factory. And if you think about it, you even use the same language, right? You're told what to do by a supervisor. If you have a question, you're not supposed to figure it out. You raise your hand and you ask your supervisor, what should I do? And then periodically you get a performance review. And if your performance review is good, you get promoted to to the next level. Then periodically a bell rings and you do different work, and then another bell rings and you do different work. And so you can think like, okay, they were trying to make people homogenous so they could go to work in a factory that understood all that. Now, we need different skills today, and we talk in a second about what those are, but I don't know that it's actually, I'm 53 years old. If I went back to high school in 1987 is when I graduated, there's only one class I could have taken that would be useful to me today, and that is typing, which I did not take. And what that tells me is there's really nothing. K through 12 is not a vocational thing. Everything I do in my job, I did what your listeners did, I'm sure, and that is we teach ourselves. We find out, oh my gosh, I need to know about something, and then you start reading about it, and then it's 3 a.m. and you clicked on all these links, and that ability to teach yourself, that is the superpower. And the good news is everybody on the planet can do it. Like everybody at every level can teach themselves new things. So I don't actually lay awake at night worrying that the 11th grade, like, you know, do we need to teach everybody trigonometry? I don't think so, but I don't think it really matters in the grand scheme of things, because if you're worried about, if you think about jobs, there's really nothing that you could teach them today that in 10 years is going to be the same. So you teach people how to teach themselves. So I mentioned to you, my wife and I homeschooled 4 kids. You know, in retrospect, maybe we should have put one in public school, like a control kid, and then experiment on the other 3 and kind of compare the results, but we didn't. We just went all in. And I think, you know, I think it's very few things. You've got to figure out what it is you're passionate about, which I think the people I know who are most happy and fulfilled with their jobs enjoy what they do. And if you're able to do that and learn how to teach yourself new things. And then our society today rewards communication. I think about my father. My father left college, and I bet he never wrote another word, never wrote a word rest of his life. Maybe he wrote a letter to an editor or something. And what do? We write all day long.
And that's exactly kind of where I think we were going with this too, is the world is changing so much so fast. And when I think of what I did, 5 years, college, university, the whole gamut, and did well. And when I graduated while I was still working, there was really nothing that I can think of that was highly useful to get a job to start my own business. The only thing that I think was the best experience I had was my class on speaking, public speaking. I loved it. That was great. I wanted more of that. But everything else, even marketing, was just talking about things done in the past, but not things that you can do in the future or where you could go. Mm-hmm. Though it was stimulating as well. I would say my marketing was stimulating. My public speaking was very useful. Everything else changed. I see people that they graduate university and they go, the world's different. You can't really use it too much. And I love what you said about the fact that we have to self-teach. We have to put that together and look at what's changing, what next year and the year after, and then learn based on that, as opposed to learn something that was put together and written in a book, you know, years ago.
I couldn't agree more.
One last thing you said something very startling, striking. You are very successful, and you said you probably failed 5 out of 6 times. So I'd like to ask you, if you can go back and think, what was your biggest failure and what did you learn from it?
Well, I have a lot of them. I mean, I would say it this way. A true story. I had a website once that had a lot of traffic, and I needed to monetize it. So I said, well, I'll just start some businesses and I'll run ads to sell something on my website. So I started coming up with businesses, and I had 2 ideas at one time. I had two ideas, and one of them was, I'm going to send letters from Santa Claus to kids. Their parents will pay $10, and I will mail the letters from North Pole, Alaska. And kids will get a letter from Santa, postmarked North Pole. And then I thought, second business. They used to have singing telegrams, right? Or at least in the movies. And I said, we should bring that back, but do it on the telephone. So for $10, you can, you know, put your friend's phone number and pick a date and pick a song, and somebody calls and sings to them, right? So we launched both of those. The singing telegrams was just, we did not sell any. I don't mean that like I'm rounding. Nobody ordered one. Like, my mother did not order one. Nobody in the entire world wanted one of those. Letters from Santa, on the other hand, I've sold 600,000 of those.
Wow.
And I couldn't tell the difference between those two ideas. I couldn't tell the difference between those two ideas going into them. And so I just sort of figured that, you know, the first thing I do is I don't ever internalize the failure, or I try not to. I say, you know, that idea failed. Like, that was a terrible idea. Who in the world would have ever thought it was a good idea? And therefore, I don't feel like I'm, you know, weighed down with failure. And the other thing is, when things do work, you also have to know it's not you either. Like, you can't let it go to your head and think you're all that or anything like that. Oh, that idea worked. I am very grateful for that. So part of it is just like emotionally distancing yourself from the outcome, because to the extent that you're involved in it, you're, I think, going to make poorer choices. I also think that the way we make decisions, people are prone to thinking, to believing what they think. And that's a hard thing to reject, but your brain is a sneaky thing. Like, don't believe everything it tells you. And even worse, you know, the way, when you have a hard decision to make, let's say you're a CEO and, you know, one person thinks we ought to do this, one person thinks we ought to do that. And so you have this meeting, and the person who thinks one, you know, has their passionate thing and makes their argument, has their deck, and second person, not as much. We weigh them and we say, okay, that person did better. I'm going with that. But the person who can, like, debate the best isn't any more likely to be right than the other person. So it's like a lot of these skills that we learn that we use to navigate that seem very common sense to us aren't necessarily. So I've had just tons of those. I mean, if I just started rattling them off to you, they're going to sound really funny. Because after we were selling all the Santa letters, I was like, you know, I bet people want a white Christmas every year. I'm going to buy some of those machines that they use at ski slopes, and I'm going to start making snow, and I'm going to rent a warehouse and keep it chilled, and I'm going to make all this snow, and I'm going to send it to people who don't live in cold places so they can have snowball fight on Christmas. That was a bad idea, which is terrible. It was fun. But it was a terrible idea, just awful. And so at some point, you know, I don't laugh about them during them, but they don't scar me. They don't weigh me down. So
great, great stories about your past failures and successes. Once again, we talked about Shaping the Future with Byron Rees, and you can find him at ByronRees.com. Byron, thanks so much for sharing with us today. Very stimulating. It's changed my outlook on what I think the future holds, what it can hold. But it's given me, not that I am without hope, but it's given me more hope on being able to shape and control even my own future and my own business. Thank you so much. Very profound and informative and stimulating, mentally stimulating. Thank you so much.
Well, that is very, very kind of you to say. And if you ever would like me to come back, I would love to.
Hey, thanks for hanging out with me while I featured an elite entrepreneur who took his vision to reality. Very stimulating conversation. We discussed Shaping the Future with Byron Rees. I think we went all over the universe, past, present, and future. We talked about AI and the optimism for it. We talked about automation, good, bad, and different. We talked about the future of work, jobs tomorrow. We talked about innovating in the world. We talked about education. So much so, I'd like to know, what resonated with you. What did you like? Tell us about it. And please remember supporting the show with a nice review on Apple Podcasts. And also, I know I say this a lot, please share this with a few friends to help them too, okay? Thank you so much. And let's use this to help you move on your journey to success. Thanks. And remember, just take action. Success awaits those who persevere and remain steadfast despite the odds. Sow good seeds, do good deeds, and join me on the next episode of The Tony D'Urso Show.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of The Tony D'Urso Show with his key influencers. Be sure to tune in again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Influencers Channel.